You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 28th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nick Marks, author of That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. Then later in the show, Odessa Kelly will be joining us, running for Congress in Tennessee's 7th District. Meanwhile, after what seems like endless negotiations, a year after their secret backroom deal on Build Back Better, Schumer and Manchin have an actual agreement on a severely watered-down reconciliation package that is called the Inflation Reduction Act. Yeah, Joe, the broccoli's candy. It tastes just like it. We'll call it inflation.
Believe reduction. It when I see it.
Yeah, I know. Cinema can still sink it, by the way. This comes after, strategically so, the Senate officially passed the CHIPS bill and is sending it to the House. House Democrats have introduced a new proposal that would ban members of Congress, senior aides, and spouses from holding and trading stocks. They'd have to put their holdings in a blind trust. The vote on that one should be interesting. And in the Senate, Republicans just used a procedural measure to block health care improvements for veterans suffering from injuries from burn pit smoke and Agent Orange. Like, they really are who they say they are. The DOJ has obtained a warrant to access the contents of Trump attorney John Eastman's phone, so that's heating up. And Mick Mulvaney is next up to testify in front of the January 6th committee.
Ooh, he turned on Trump, didn't he?
He did.
Let's see how fully.
Now he's a...
just a wonk.
Right.
Just a wonk.
Just a wonk. Don't look at the rest of his Wikipedia page.
Not a crime doer, just a wonk.
Two former Minneapolis cops who stood by as George Floyd was murdered have been sentenced to 3 and 3.5 years in federal prison for civil rights violations. The U.S. has offered up an imprisoned Russian arms dealer in exchange for the release of WNBA star Brittany Griner. And lastly, Biden is expected to declare monkeypox a public health emergency soon and distribute hundreds of thousands of doses of vaccines. A public health emergency declaration would unshackle the HHS to do more to combat it. So that is a good move. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to another edition of an Majority Report Thursday. You know, I'm really leaning into that branding.
Hooray.
Perhaps because of pending merch.
Yeah. Financially motivated.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to be savvy and really just like make sure that Sam cuts me in on that deal.
Yeah.
For all those shirts. So you guys better buy all of them. Honestly. But probably not.
She's not coming for 5%.
I'm coming for all of it. What's that from?
Social Network.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the best movies of the past 20 years.
Great movie.
If you created a Majority Report, you would be hosting a Majority Report.
And I am, bitch. Whoa.
Oh.
Whoa. I'm going blue like Trump. So Joe Manchin and Chuck Schumer have an agreement. Woo-hoo. I mean, as David Dayen points out in his piece in The American Prospect, which I'd encourage, as always, everybody to check out, it's been almost a year to this date since Manchin and Schumer signed that secret agreement in the middle of these Build Back Better negotiations, which...
And that made everyone go through a farce of
right.
negotiations for an entire summer.
Even though secretly Manchin was only willing to go to a $1.5 trillion number, they got it down to that, and he still wasn't on board with it. So forgive me if I'm a little skeptical about this agreement, but it does seem like this time might be different. I say that with trepidation. But because Manchin seems to, I think, be feeling the heat a little bit more than he normally does, and he gets to brand this as a way to combat inflation, which is his whole thing now.
Sure.
Back when that was being debated, that was a $1.5 trillion figure. This is much lower than that, the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. And before I get into it, though, I do want to give Schumer a rare piece of credit for strategy on this front. Maybe not even the content of the bill, but he wanted chips passed really badly. The semiconductor China competitive bill, which has a needless jingoistic framing, but yeah. That's a way to get Republicans on board. And honestly,
also Nancy Pelosi's husband likes wanted the chips bill passed too.
Oh yes, he does have investment in that.
Just sold off all of his Nvidia stock at a loss.
Interesting. Yeah, people should look into his. There's a whole like Reddit forum I think for his stock portfolio. It's a great way to make money if you follow that. But they waited to announce the agreement until after CHIPS passed the Senate over the filibuster threshold. There were, I think, 17 Republicans that joined on board with it so that the reconciliation route could be preserved for this. And I do think that they actually fooled Mitch McConnell into believing that the Manchin and Schumer agreement, that the shadow of Build Back Better was dead, because if he wasn't fooled, he would have whipped his caucus, I believe, to vote against CHIPS, to force the Democrats into a reconciliation, going down the reconciliation path with that particular bill, which would take away that option for this new bill. They took away McConnell's leverage by hiding the ball to that degree. And I think that that is backed up by this clip here of Senator Kennedy, who went on Fox News to talk about how they've been duped, which is, you know, a rare moment of Schadenfreude for Democrats to see Republicans get outmaneuvered on something for once.
But the timing of the Senator Manchin deal, I don't think was any accident.
What do you mean?
The Democrats had some of my colleagues in the Senate agreed to support the 400 or 390 or 290, whatever it was. I can't count that high.
280.
Subsidy to big tech. Okay? And so they couldn't have passed that bill without Republican votes. So the Democrats, well, basically, they sucked my Republican votes up like a Hoover Deluxe and then got their votes and then, bam, announced this new tax increase.
Double cross.
I don't think there aren't very many coincidences here on Capitol Hill. I think that the timing was exquisite. We look like a bunch of, well, I'm not going to say what we look like.
Ha ha. Sorry. Love it. I mean, look. The there's nothing in either the CHIPS bill, which is a corporate giveaway for semiconductor manufacturing as a way to create some jobs here in the United States, but there's no assurances after we're giving taxpayer money to these companies that they are going to do such a thing.
It's just more of like a pinky promise. Those companies then.
Yeah, if we want to give public money to them, we should get something in return. That's what Bernie Sanders said. He was the lone member of the Democratic caucus, I believe, to not support it in the Senate. And he's right. But it did pass. And that later that day, Manchin and Schumer announced this agreement. So Kennedy is right there that it was strategic. And they got got.
I think so. I think the one thing I'm worried about is the degree that this is performative, and it really all depends on if this actually goes through.
Yeah.
Because if not, then I could very easily imagine that Kennedy is going on there and squawking a little bit and acting put upon because he's doing a solid for Manchin or even Schumer.
I think cinema is going to be the bigger problem.
I think the strong issue is that I was saying this to Matt earlier, is that Manchin has always been more amenable to the tax increase part than the climate stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Sinema's the opposite.
Yes.
So the concern is, will she...
What are you eating?
I was eating a protein bar. The concern is it's my 12:10 breakfast.
Yeah, I got you.
usually she is the one who has been opposed to any corporate tax increase or any higher tax increase as opposed to the climate provisions. But then also we have to think about the mod squad in the House too.
Mm-hmm.
Gottheimer, Mikey Sherrill, Tom Malinowski, all of the New Jersey and New York Democrats who will not vote for anything that doesn't have the salt provision in there.
Yeah, great point. I think that there is still a long road, but for what's in this bill, as I mentioned, last year it was $1.5 trillion. This year, according to Dayan's reporting, and I'm sure he was up all night looking through like the hundreds of pages of text on this, $433 billion. So significantly less. What it does is it extends the ACA subsidies for 3 years. It limits drug pricing reform, allows for Medicare to... It's limited drug pricing reform that allows Medicare to negotiate with pharma on a few drugs, but
such
not
piddly stuff. It's important.
Not insulin.
It's going to help, I'm certain, in individual cases.
And it's for seniors, too. Like, it caps $2,000 on seniors' annual out-of-pocket cost for prescription drugs under Medicare.
It's like we're going to untie this hand that we tied behind our back.
Right.
Like,
but, like, at the same time, you know, I want these things to go through, and I think in particular the climate stuff is like, it's all meant to incentivize the private sector. I'll get to that in a second, but what the other good parts are, $80 billion in IRS investment, which is good, so that's a way to cut down on tax dodging, and Manchin wants that as a pay-for, which we've discussed on this program, you don't really need, but Manchin is committed to that. It also has a corporate minimum tax, which I need to look into more, but it seems pretty weak. That's another pay for that Manchin wanted. The one thing I think that is kind of good in this is there's a funding for a direct e-file tax return system. So you don't have to go to TurboTax and pay out the, you know, I don't know, how much does that cost? Like $100 a year to file your taxes through there? Yeah, this would be a way for people to do it directly through the government. But Bradley mentioned this about cinema's potential role in this. There was a tweak in this to a carried interest loophole, which cinema wants to protect naturally. That was one of the things that she hung her hat on. It extends the holding period on the carried interest loophole from 3 to 5 years, but that's shorter than the length of most private equity deals, which is where this would be felt most acutely. Those are usually 5 to 7 years. So it's easy to circumvent, and so maybe that's designed to get her on board. It's just window dressing. And the climate stuff, at least there's something there. It's targeting a 40% emissions reduction by 2030, but much of it is just, again, private sector incentivization and investments in fuel-neutral energy. But I think it way too much of an over-focus on carbon capture, which is just a way to appeal to Manchin, right?
Right.
Carbon capture technologies are not serious.
Like, I would love it if they were, but they're not.
It's not. It's not a viable way to move forward. And then, of course, you know, electric and zero-emission vehicle credits.
No, it seems like essentially the extraneous stuff is what is appealing to Manchin, in the sense of,
yes,
like, the deficit reduction planks and the carbon capture planks to add on with the other kind of more benevolent stuff. It's like, let's put the BS in there, basically, for Manchin to be on board and feel self-important.
And it's not worth, I think, celebrating. I think, like, it's fair enough if the best of this gets through and passes. It's like, okay, this is an example why it's better to have Democrats in power than Republicans. It's still absolutely not up to...
Not sufficient,
and maybe even makes future action harder, because Manchin's got his stuff from it, right? So, like, fine, if it passes, I'm not going to give any of these people credit until it does, and even so, it's not enough.
Yeah, just remain vigilant, folks.
Of course. And now I just keep thinking about how much we're going to see of Josh Gottheimer on TV.
He's getting that little, that short king is tightening his tie.
And then we can wonder why
so many beverages
are alienated from politics, because we have to go from Manchin to cinema to Gottheimer. Like, this is these insanity.
These ghouls at the gate.
Bought fuses for capitalism, as Matt Crisman points out. They replaceable you know, people who are just serving, like, the carried interest concerned crowd.
Right. We have to protect private equity mergers.
Justice for private equity.
Justice. Yes, queen. With that said, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Nick Marks. We are back, and we are joined now by Nick Marks, one of the authors of That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. Nick, thanks so much for being here today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So right-wing comedy should sound like an oxymoron, I think, to a good percentage of our audience, right? But, you know, your book actually contends that we need to be taking it seriously as a phenomenon, and I think long-time viewers of this program or even casual viewers know we spend a lot of time mocking right-wing comedy, but it is, you know, I think our way of combating it and getting into the algorithm because it can be so pernicious. What inspired you to write about it and what inspired you to say, hey, let's take this seriously and acknowledge it really from like a sociological perspective?
So two things, really. The start of the Trump administration really created a permission structure for more kind of informal, let's call it, forms of address, public discourse, and joking, mean-spirited joking, to occur in formal political spaces. He wasn't necessarily the cause of it, but maybe the most sort of prominent face of a movement happening over the last 5 to 10 years. And what we see happening at the same time is an opening in media industries where nobody's really occupied this lane economically. So there hadn't been an institution devoted to conservative comedy in the same way that liberals have long had institutions like Saturday Night Live, The Daily Show. So we see a couple of failed attempts to do this, most notably Fox News's Half Hour News Hour in 2007. Yes, a very regrettable, bad attempt to be The Daily Show, but they try and try and eventually succeed with a handful of the folks that we talk about in the book. At the same time, liberals are kind of tunnel visioned into thinking that we own comedy. We're the party of Jon Stewart, of Stephen Colbert, of Sacha Baron Cohen, all these sort of brilliant liberal comedians that we've had over the last two decades. And we kind of fall into this trap of thinking that comedy has a politically liberal orientation and that anything that falls outside of our political goals must not be comedy. It must be something else. So it's kind of a two-pronged thing where conservatives are rising in the comedy world at the same time liberals are tunnel-visioned on celebrating our own satirists.
Yeah, and I there's two responses I have to that. One is I think the liberal can be distinct from leftist, and the comedy that comes out of a Jon Stewart to a degree is different than I would say comedy that's a bit more challenging of institutions. And secondly, when I just lost my second point, but I guess when you bring up right-wing comedy, I'm thinking right now of someone like Dave Chappelle or a lot of comics who were not perceived as a part of a right-wing ethos, but they are tapping into a reactionary impulse about trans people in particular, and that's gaining a lot of steam.
Yeah, absolutely. So to take those one by one, we use the terms liberal and leftist interchangeably, not because I think they're interchangeable. I myself identify as a leftist, but we kind of are making a broad sort of coalitional point that, hey, we got to work together to sort of combat this. The second characterization of right-wing comedians like Chappelle as reactionary, I think, is spot on. He happens to be maybe a very public, high-profile case, as is somebody like Joe Rogan, who tends to have some reactionary views too. But they're just the sort of tip of the spear. There's a whole universe, including personalities on Fox News like Greg Gutfeld and Jesse Waters, podcasters like the Legion of Skanks, and even folks who are kind of much more nefarious, fascist adjacent sort of podcasters, streamers, who are very avowedly right wing, and to call them conservative would be a sort of polite nod to their politics. I think Chappelle right now is an interesting case because he's kind of going where the money is. I think he sees that the lane he previously occupied has now been populated by new and upcoming and more interesting voices. And he's hanging out with Rogan and Austin and appearing at some of these spots. And maybe Elon Musk is in the periphery somewhere. That libertarian tech bro scene, I think, has filtered into his sensibility a little bit. But whatever it is about the trans issue, that seems to be a very sort of a dividing line between these comedians who want to veer leftward versus the ones that might see a more fertile economic space on the right.
And your book talks really about how a lot of the comedic the impulses for some of these right-wing comedians or the audience they're trying to cultivate, it's a very male and it's a very white audience. What is it about the trans issue in particular, the trans issue, but the trans people and demonizing trans people and hating on them in what's using the trappings of comedy as a way to do so. What is it about that I think hits on all those points?
Yeah. Another comedy outlet we talk about in the book is the Babylon Bee, and they go to this well often, sort of the pronoun sets of jokes and talking about trans confusions with gender identities. We talk in the book about a robust body of social science research that says conservatives can't deal with ambivalence. They don't like unresolved issues, ideas, identity categories. That's why they tend to hold to sort of firmly thought out identity positions and political ideologies, whereas liberals tend to embrace ambivalence and sort of ambiguous forms of joking and discourse. I think trans debates happens to be the sort of talking point that's cycling through the comedy world right now. Lord knows it'll become something else in 2-3 years when a new sort of issue arises. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, it would have been gay marriage, right? But the sort of issue of gender remains pretty prominent in that world of humor.
Yeah. So what do you attribute that to in terms of that not maybe 15 years ago it being about gay people? And I mean, there's like Andrew Dice Clay or people like that from that time period. But why now? What has created, is it Trump, would you say, that's given this, taken us to this inflection point in this period? How would you, what's your best guess about that?
Is it Trump that's taken us to the inflection point about trans issues or
yeah,
others?
Why? I mean, there of course were comedians making fun of gay people before this, but I feel like now there's much more of an appetite for that kind of mockery towards trans people, different from and distinct from 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's a good question, and not one I'm sure I have a total authority to speak on, other than to identify it as a sort of cultural issue that the right is struggling to gain territory on. If we take seriously, as I do, the sort of Breitbartian edict that politics is downstream from culture, they hold political control, right? They're a sort of minority rule of political power in the country. So they spend all their time with the Ben Shapiros of the world, Steven Crowders of the world, complaining about being canceled for cultural issues, right? I think part of it has to do with a kind of underlying libertarian ethos to a lot of their comedy too. Because this is an issue that exists in the public sphere, I must take the most extreme humorous viewpoint possible on it. If I'm not taking that extreme viewpoint, then I'm not being funny, right? Then I'm not doing justice to my sort of political perspective. Again, I can't say with any certainty why the sort of trans debate cycles through their comedy universe so prominently. It almost certainly has to do with the presence of overwhelmingly cisgendered white men leading this comedy movement. But beyond that, I'm just not sure.
So let's your book kind of works to with the least extreme with Fox News. You start in, I believe, your second chapter talking about the half hour news hour and now Gutfeld's show, which is surprisingly doing well in the ratings. And then you move towards gradually becoming more extreme towards neo-Nazi comedy meme edgelord stuff. And all of this is a part of the same whole. But let's start there where with Fox, because it's the most digestible form of this kind of hateful comedy for a lot of people. I think you described it as this complex is Walmart, right? Where it's a one-stop shop for people. What did you find in your study of Fox's approach to right-wing comedy?
Yeah, so we use the metaphor of a mixed-use shopping complex to describe the right-wing comedy industry. So it's got a big box store in the form of Greg Gutfeld and Jesse Waters on Fox News. And this is the mainstream form of it, the one that might be most familiar to folks watching late-night television, to industry people tracking it, right, to competitors like Colbert and The Daily Show and others. And what we find with Gutfeld is a straight-up late-night comedy talk show. He is generically exactly the same as Trevor Noah is on Comedy Central. That's not to say that their jokes are the same or that I find it funny, but the host, Gutfeld, does a monologue. He riffs on headlines of the day. He's got an Ed McMahon-like sidekick in Tyrus, this hulking former wrestler, an in-house group of sketch players, not unlike what Conan O'Brien had back in the day. And so generically, industrially, it is a late-night comedy talk show. But what we find throughout discussions of Gutfeld is that people are hesitant to call it that. Academics like myself are reluctant to apply that label. Trade magazines like The Hollywood Reporter call it comedy-oriented and not necessarily an out-and-out comedy show like you might call Colbert, because I think there's this ingrained reluctance to acknowledge something that is conservative and is funny can exist in the world. You used the word oxymoronic earlier on in the conversation. And I think that's the kind of implicit logic a lot of folks on the left have, is that, well, those two things can't possibly go together, so it must be something else. It must be this extension of Fox's kind of outrage programming. And to be clear, there is a good deal of that. There are the sort of personality cycling through the show to just sort of shake their fist at the cloud and be angry about open borders or whatever the case is. But there are setups and punchlines and a studio audience who's laughing at Gutfeld and all the sort of familiar beats you might expect in a sort of mainstream comedy show like we have on the broadcast networks.
And you know, then you move into the Ben Shapiros and Steven Crowders of the world, who we are way too familiar with here at the Majority Report. Crowder is a great example, I think, for your thesis here, because he is constantly, you know, doing these bits and dressing up and things like that. And in particular, I would say his comedy attempts, I have a hard time couching it, I'm sorry, But it's about directly harassing and joking about minority groups or gay people or trans people. I mean, in watching his programming and in writing about it, what were some of the through lines that you found?
Yeah, I think just as you described it, his is a comedy of owning the libs. It may not always be the same as a stand-up performer getting on stage doing a traditional routine, even though he's tried that and failed pretty horribly at it. But he is the change my mind guy, right? I'm sure your viewers know, but he sets his card table up on college campuses with a sign that says, there are only two genders, change my mind. And these well-meaning college kids stumble out of their women's studies classes and debate him. And Crowder says, well, if there are infinite number of genders, how many genders are there? So it's not necessarily the familiar kind of joking convention we see in sitcoms and late night TV, but his is a humor of superiority. It's finding a weaker, more marginalized cultural subject and pointing down at them, laughing at them in order to unite like-minded people behind him. You see this very explicitly in many of those Change My Mind videos. He's got a crowd of people around him. He's got somebody who's going to be the target of his jokes, and he punches down at them. And you hear the crowd laughing behind him in much the same way that a stand-up might be doing crowd work to somebody who's heckling them, right? Again, it's not necessarily always funny, but it is grounded in the sort of unifying principle of in-groups and out-groups. He's very explicit about trying to create a dividing line between people who believe what I do, there are only two genders, and then there's the loony libs who we're going to laugh at and we're going to own them with our humor.
Yeah, and there is a lot that Trump borrows from all of these people, right? I mean, I've gotten into debates with liberal family members, particularly older people, who, you know, they don't see Trump as funny because they find him offensive. And of course, he's an odious human being, but he's also an insult comic. Yeah. And that is, not understanding that means you don't understand Donald Trump, in my opinion. And he also has those same principles of punching down at other groups. And I'm wondering how much of his persona was reminiscent in studying someone like Crowder and other right-wingers in your book.
Yeah, he absolutely looms very large over many of the case studies in this book, especially somebody like Crowder and to a lesser extent Shapiro, who's kind of this ringleader for many of the comedians we talk about. The cruelty is the point, right? And it's undeniable to acknowledge that humor is a part of that cruelty. It's a part of that unifying principle behind, oh, mocking the disabled reporter or calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas or on and on and on. The number of times he's name called, that he's punched down at people in positions of lower authority than him. So the point is to move the discussion about what is and is not comedy away from a taste-based evaluation. So I don't think he's funny, but I'm not going to deny that he's trying to be funny or that he can be funny for his political adherence. So for too long, we've categorized comedy very subjectively. We've used our own taste to say what is and is not comedy, but we don't do that with other art forms. We might not like a painting hanging in a museum, but we wouldn't deny that it is a painting, right? We tend not to use that taste-based distinction in other art forms. But for so long, especially in political comedy, we've used our taste to say, no, Jon Stewart is funny because I agree with him. Steven Crowder is not because he's just angry all the time, right? Or Donald Trump is just being vicious or mean or angry. And that's absolutely true, but he is also trying to be funny for his audience.
What do you think the danger is in not recognizing that on the left?
Yeah, so the one of the bigger points we try to make is the attractiveness of this art form for young male listeners and viewers. Overwhelmingly, the folks listening to Rogan, to Legion of Skanks, to other forms of right-wing comedy are these kind of politically neutral, still in formation, young male listeners. And so the danger is that this cultural form is used to recruit them to right-wing causes, to the Republican Party, to incorporate them into the voting base as that right-leaning voting base ages out and dies or whatever the case is. I don't have hardcore sort of sociological statistics saying X number of folks are joining the Republican Party based on listening to these programs. But
it's obvious. Yeah. Right.
If you listen to Rogan and the Libertarian podcast, the ad spots, the ad reads he does are overwhelmingly for 22-year-old dudes, right? It's off-brand Viagra and ButcherBox and all these things that you buy if you've got a disposable income.
Okay. And so you mentioned Rogan there, right? That's somebody who you explore in your fourth chapter as we begin to go down this wormhole. He's constantly couching his right wing framing in, you know, hey, I'm just a dude, I'm just a podcaster, don't take me super seriously, which I think is a real hallmark of right-wing influencers to a degree, is a denial that they are political, because it is a way to sell a right-wing framing to people who might not want to see themselves as a right-winger, particularly young men, when it's not terribly fashionable in my age group to be a right-winger. What were some of the hallmarks of his show that you found notable?
Yeah, so Rogan's a tricky figure because he's not got politics, he's got demographics. I think his first mission is to serve this very lucrative young male listening audience, 10 million, 11 million listeners per episode, to Spotify and to his advertisers. He's someone who's been on mic and doing stand-up and in the public eye long enough that he can plausibly affirm or deny any given political ideology. And he often does, right? He says, oh, I had Bernie Sanders on, but of course he flipped to Trump after Sanders dropped out. The point with Rogan, though, is not necessarily to catch him as a right-wing ideologue according to what he says, but it's the connections he has to all these other figures, many of whom we cover in the book, but all these other figures in the conservative political world and the right-wing cultural universe overwhelmingly picture him as somebody libertarian, as somebody right-wing sympathetic. So the recommendations, for instance, that pop up when you listen to the Rogan experience regularly are podcasters like Legion of Skanks, whom we talk about, Michael Malice, who then connect you to other further rights, further fascist adjacent kind of nefarious characters who exist in the basement of this complex that we talk about. But I often have students tell me very understandably, oh, Rogan's my favorite podcaster because he just kind of tells it like it is. And it's easy to imagine, you know, them hanging out with Rogan, just getting high and talking shit with their bros. And that's fine. I'm not here to judge anybody's preference for listening to that. But it's the industry built around Rogan. Once you go in the front door of what Rogan has to show you, he takes you back to the back room where a guy is going to sell you something even more sort of pernicious and influencing you to go further and further down this kind of fascist right-wing rabbit hole.
How do you respond to the Rogan fans who say, well, look, he's had Bernie Sanders on, or he's had Cornel West on, or he's had some lefties on? I mean, to me, I don't listen to Rogan at all, really, except for the purposes of my job to disentangle some of his right-wing stuff. But it's clear to me that those are outliers. But I'm curious what your response is to that claim.
The first response is what you just said. The centrist to left personalities he has on are outliers compared to the dozens and even hundreds of Milo Yiannopoulos's and Jordan Peterson's and all these people who become associated in a bigger context with conservative political causes and with right-wing cultural issues. The second bigger point that I would make is look at the industry built up around him. Look at who he hangs out with. Look at the shows that he guests on and the people who go to guest on other shows. Who does he go on tour with? Who are the sort of people advertising on his show? Over and over again, it pushes in the rightward direction and paints a picture of somebody who is skeptical of trans rights, right? All the sort of left-oriented issues we've been talking about. Overwhelmingly, he's angry about, skeptical of. He doesn't like institutional voices when it comes to COVID vaccines and on. So the small slice that he can point to justifiably saying, no, man, I like pro-marijuana legalization, or I'm going to have Bernie Sanders on, pales in comparison to the bigger constellation of right-wing personalities that he pals around with.
And you mentioned just the ecosystem around him as well. Like Jordan Peterson you could really draw a line to his career trajectory now as a almost exclusively anti-trans contributor to the Daily Wire as a function of Rogan's platforming. I mean, that is that was very instrumental to his rise.
Yeah, precisely. So Rogan kind of provides the joking entree into these more sort of self-serious political domains that Jordan Peterson occupies, or that various libertarian thinkers like him occupy as well. So the sort of comedy that forms the basis of how Rogan interacts with guests, the just bullshitting with the fellows kind of vibe, opens the door to more politically serious conversations and ideologies if a listener wishes to pursue them.
And lastly, speaking of Rogan guests, Gavin McGinnis is someone you highlight in your final chapter, I believe, or chapter five, where you and your co-author, who I believe, I'm so sorry, I did not say his name, if you don't mind plugging him for a sec.
Yeah, it's Matt Sinkowitz.
Matt Sinkowitz, yes. You both write about the kind of final stage in a radicalization wormhole, which is basically neo-Nazi edgelord meme stuff, mm-hmm. Gavin McGinnis, the Boogaloo Boys, these kinds of folks. That's when you get into incredibly scary territory, but it's also just the natural progression of when you fall into these radicalizing traps.
Yeah, so crucially, we're not saying that Greg Gutfeld, Joe Rogan are the same as these fascist and neo-Nazi podcasts we talk about later in the book. But our hope is to highlight that it's possible to get there, right? If you spend enough time in this right-wing comedy complex, you eventually get connected to via social media algorithms, via guests on various podcasts, recommendations to these sort of more nefarious characters. And indeed, it's not that tough to get there in the form of McGinnis, who was a pretty regular guest on Fox News shows like Red Eye, which Greg Gutfeld hosted for years before getting his own show. He's circulated through the sort of hipster vice universe of New York in the 2000s before turning hard into the right-wing universe and trying to be funny while doing it with this trolling vibe that he's got, right? Just kidding, just joking. As a leader of the Proud Boys, I don't endorse any of the sort of violent acts they're doing. That's all just a humorous facade, except and until his Proud Boys actually go out and beat up journalists and harass Black Lives Matter protesters. So he's among the more sort of above ground public faces of this sort of trolling universe that we describe. When you get to the really subterranean stuff, the things that Google won't even bring to your first couple of pages of searches, there are out-and-out Nazis who routinely joke about Holocaust and Jews who control media industries, right? They are not doing this with any sort of sheen of irony. They are very nakedly open about how hateful and fascistic they are in their ideas. But again, the element of owning the left, of making a sort of small in-group of fascist ideologues laugh along with you is core to their appeal. They're not just angry. They're not just hateful. They are making jokes in the same way that any other comedian might to create an in-group and an out-group.
And to bring it back to Trump, because I really see him as the culmination of a lot of these dynamics, given, again, the edgelord, you know, 4chan guys love that he owns the libs through his relentless trolling. I mean, he is the ultimate troll, and that is kind of, I think, key to their identity, and humor is a way for people to identify themselves, what people connect to and what people find funny. And Steve Bannon, recently convicted Steve Bannon, found this to be a really a way to radicalize young men, essentially. Mm-hmm. Through Gamergate, he understood that there were a group of online men who found solace in forums and found solace in this kind of edgy comedy. And so that all ties together, in my opinion, to build a young, alt-right, angry base of largely white male right-wingers that becomes a very dangerous situation, and we see their influence on mass shooters. And we also see that this is a way to keep the right-wing project younger, and however hateful they are, how anti-Semitic, racist, transphobic, gay, doesn't matter, because honestly that makes them probably more useful for the right if they're more engaged in that way.
That's totally right. The Bannon radicalizing gamers example is a great sort of analog to what we view potentially happening with comedy. It's a very online form of discourse, so folks engaging in it don't ever really have to suffer the real world consequences or meet the objects of their joking derision. It's something that is available to anybody as a result, right? If you're sort of siloed in your own little social media filter bubble, you can just joke around with people who think the same way you do and not have to be exposed to anybody outside of it. And then what's more, we see this mode of joking filter back up to the people who hold power in right-wing thought. I'm forgetting the conference. Y'all talked about it on the show earlier this week where Ted Cruz and Matt Gaetz came
Turning
out.
Points
Turning
Points USA.
The Charlie Kirk conference. So, you know, that whole sort of, they had like pro wrestler introductions and they were trying to make jokes, right? They were trying to be funny because they knew that they were at a gathering of mostly young white men. And that was the sort of mode of discourse that would resonate with them. Not conventional policy oriented speeches, but I'm forgetting that didn't Ted Cruz have some punchline about his pronouns being F that or something?
Yeah,
like
pronouns are kiss my ass. If you think of somebody who's less naturally funny, even he is trying to be funny.
So they're reaching for that branch of humor now, even if it's going to snap off on them, because they know it's an attractive thing to kind of bring in that young male voting base.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Nick Marks. You can read his book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them, along with his co-author, Matt Sinkowitz. Thank you so much, Nick, for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Emma.
Of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Odessa Kelly, who is running for Congress in Tennessee's 7th District. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by congressional candidate Odessa Kelly, running in Tennessee's 7th District. Odessa, thanks so much for being here today. Looking forward to talking to you.
I'm stoked, and I'm glad you have me on.
Of course. So you are running in Tennessee's 7th District, which is, what, parts of Nashville? What else does it include? Because it's recently been redrawn, has it not been?
Yes, it's insane. The racist Republicans at our state legislature had a field day with our maps. So, yes, it runs from Kentucky to Alabama in the state of Tennessee. We have a third of Nashville. We have the three largest counties are that Montgomery County, which includes Clarksville, Tennessee, Williamson County, which is a bits and pieces of Franklin, and we have 11 other rural counties.
So this redistricting was a way to basically turn one solidly blue district into three red districts, pretty much, right?
Girl, they tried it. But, yeah. You know, they had no idea where Black people live and where all these progressives who have been moving into Nashville lived. So, you know, they pushed a lot more progressive and Democrats into District 7, you know. So we still are going to win this district. You know, we just have to climb uphill a little bit harder. But who climbs uphill better than Black people and oppressed people? So,
yeah. So you know, your district.
Well, for the challenge.
Right, right. Like when I was reading a bit about your district, one of the bright spots and the ways that I think that, you know, maybe Republicans didn't think it through too much is that this when they divided up these districts, the district that you're running in does have more Black voters than the other divvied up district.
Yeah, it has more Black voters. It has a large working class population, you know, and in rural areas as well. And, you know, one of the perks of being a person who's been a union member and fighting to raise wages across the state of Tennessee is I know a lot of people have a lot of familiarity with people in the district, you know, who already know that I come with receipts and will work really hard for the people.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit about your platform. You are a unabashed progressive, Green New Deal, mm-hmm. Medicare for all these hallmarks of leftist, thought. What brought you to that point, and why are you so strong in your stances on all those issues?
Because it's good common sense, you know, for someone to say that we are far left or progressive because we want people, what, not to starve? To have, shelter, roofs over their head, and pay dignity, paid with some dignity for the work that they do. If that's a radical thought, then this country is in really bad shape, you know. And those are all the things the majority of us are standing for and what we need every day. That's why I'm running. You know, we've forgotten about our base, and the base of the Democratic Party is working class people, you know, and we need to make sure that they can see themselves in the people who are in the leadership.
And frankly, I've been frustrated by Democratic leadership's seeming obsession with the suburban voter. And they don't seem to, outside of, you know, the Squad and other more lefty members of Congress, I feel like there is a complete taking for granted of working class voters in this country. So it's awesome that you're so front facing with that in your campaign.
Absolutely, Emma. At the end of the day, most people want more money in their pocket, less debt, and less stress. That's all we really want. You know, majority of people that I know are waking up every day not saying, like, how can I make someone else's life a living hell? It's like, how can I make my life better and the life of my family, my loved ones better? You know, and at the end of the day, when it comes to like what we could do through legislation, it's making people's lives better by alleviating a lot of those debts and stresses. And we need people who are going to actually do that.
Your primary is coming up, but you're running unopposed against Mark Green, who's a three-time incumbent Republican. This is also Marsha Blackburn's old district, is my understanding as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a long history of vile Republicans holding office in Tennessee's 7th. What is that part of what motivated you to run? The fact that there needs to be some change there?
Well, I was running for the issues, you know. That's the reason why I was running. Like, regardless of if it was Democrat or Republican, across this country, we don't have enough people who have the shared experiences what majority of us is going through every day. But I ain't gonna lie, it's an added bonus coming behind them too to have an openly gay, 6-foot-tall, very pretty Black woman who's gonna be the next congressman in this district. Oh, they gotta eat it, and I love it.
Oh yeah, I love it too. I mean, like, so you on your site, you talk about housing a lot, and Nashville, I'm curious about your perspective on what I would imagine has been a lot of gentrification, because it's, you know, a hot new city for that kind of, I think, for certain people to move to right now. And there's a lot of, I think, real estate development happening there. That's my understanding.
Everywhere.
So, I mean, what would you do to combat that? And what are some of the things you're seeing on the ground in terms of the effects on the working class population in and around Nashville?
Thank you for that question. That's absolutely how I got to this point. We're a case study for it. You know, I'm from a community as a case study of gentrification and what's happening, and you're seeing it everywhere, you know, and now it's not just Black and brown communities that are feeling it. It's a socioeconomic issue. It is working class people, people with degrees like me with a master's degree, who are also living check to check and can't afford housing here. You know, that's one of the reasons why I started running. As an activist, we kept doing all these things, you know, trying to pass inclusionary zoning acts on the local level, you know, trying to push it through the state. And we get it all the way to the finish line, Emma. And the issue was, is that we didn't have enough people in leadership to get it across the finish line. So if I get in the office, I'm going to do what I've been doing as an activist and an organizer for the past 7 years. Make sure that we listen to people who have concrete answers on how we build sustainable communities for everyone. So that way that Black and brown communities and working class communities aren't pushed out to the fringes, you know, of our communities. And I think that'll come in a myriad of ways. That's about us fighting, you know, to make, you know, on the economic standards, make sure that we can raise wages across the board federally, you know, and also making sure that we can move as many barriers out of the way for our local and state elected officials to make sure that they can push and get better housing in the urban core for the people in our district and in the city.
How would you in Congress support the unionization efforts in your state and in your district? Because Tennessee is a red state for the most part, and it's difficult. It's an uphill battle.
It is. I will say, though, after this last election, I am a proponent of Tennessee as a non-voting state. You know, and it is an oppressed state. And when we have people actually show up and vote in those cycles before where we were losing races by 20 or 30 points, you saw that a drastic change where we're losing them by a couple of points. So all that means is that we have to keep increasing, expanding the avenues for people to vote. Because when people really have an opportunity to think about the things that change their life, they really do vote in the way that we need them to vote, you know, to have a big impact. I think that. Yeah, I think it's going to be an uphill battle. It's hard to just name one actual thing that we're going to do, because you already know we need all boats to move, you know, in the upward motion if we're going to get all these things to move. And that's across housing, that's across infrastructure, that's across the intersectionality of making sure all these things work together.
You mentioned that you're a queer woman, and I feel like it's just really a disservice. That Democratic leadership, in my opinion, is doing a disservice by, I think, ceding a lot of the ground to the right, who are going balls to the wall with, like, these anti-gay bills, don't say gay, anti-trans legislation across the country. Last question, as a member of Congress, how much of an emphasis would that be for you? And, you know, would you, I think I know my answer, but I doubt that you'd shrink from that conversation.
Yeah, I'm not shrinking from it at all. You know, like, even going back to the last question and just finishing that about being, you know, moving unions forward. Yeah, I want to be a supporter of the PRO Act. You know, we all know what Janice did and ripping a lot of the teeth out of how we can really help people grow in their workplaces. If I'm gonna be bipartisan, that's because Republicans are gonna be walking across the aisle, you know, and doing everything they can to accommodate bills that we write. You know, otherwise, I mean, the bipartisanship and the things that we've seen so far have gotten us to this point, and we all feel this heaviness that we're carrying, you know, and I ain't got time for that. We got to save democracy. 1619, I done had ancestors fighting since then, you know, to get us to the point where we all are, you know, and I'd be damned if I'm going to be the one to, like, you know, live on my knees. Nah, I'm going to fight standing.
Odessa, how can people support your campaign?
Thank you for asking. You can go to odessaforcongress.com. You can sign up right there to be a volunteer there. You can donate there because it's going to pop up. You know, don't be shy. If you have money that's bored, give it to me. I know how to put it to work. You can go to Odessa Kelly TN on IG and Twitter, and Odessa for Congress on Facebook to follow us. So we love to have everyone support. Let's please fight this fight together.
Awesome. Odessa for Congress. We will be putting the links in the podcast description and everywhere else to your campaign so people can support. Really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much, Odessa.
Appreciate you. Appreciate Sam. I watch every day, and thank y'all for giving me validation. Though I ain't crazy.
No, you're
you
not.
Know that, and so I appreciate everyone. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Odessa.
All right, folks. With that said, bye. We will head into the fun half shortly. But first, last night, Matt had left Reckoning. How was it?
Yeah, we had Matt Chrisman of Chapel Trap House and Hell of Presidents on to talk about Joe Brandon and the post-Bernie left. And also, we talked, had him respond to Jordan Peterson's idea that young men are especially haunted by the weight of the moral weight of history, and how Matt, as somebody who is passionate about history and did indeed like the Hell of Presidents, how he sort of fights that or avoids entirely that sink into shameful like a shame fest when he talks about history. What is there something wrong? No, I put that up so I was on the camera, Brad. Sorry, Matt. Jeez. Okay, I guess my plug's over. Patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Bradley was camera shy.
I'm so instinctually like, is that wrong? Because usually it's the window is closing or something like that. So sorry, Matt.
All right. Well, with that said, yeah, check out Left Reckoning. And we don't have Binder and... All right, well...
I'm on the other side of the break.
Yeah. Check out the check out Doom, check out Scam Economy, check out the Discourse, all that good stuff. We'll be taking your calls and reading your IMs in the fun half, 646-257-3920. See you there.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this... Seven, eight?
Yes.
Hi, me? You're safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge Matt.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.